Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is author Andrew Nagorski. He's been Newsweek's bureau chief in Hong Kong, Moscow, Rome, Bonn, Warsaw, and Berlin. And we're talking about his new book, Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. Andrew, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Now, this is basically exactly as the title says. This is a book that details what everybody had to do to try to get Sigmund Freud out of Vienna, Austria, before the Nazis could capture him. And one of the first questions, you know, you want to, Hitler's a non-observant Jew. He's on their hit list. Why didn't he get out earlier? Why wasn't he smart enough? This seems to be one of the major issues this book deals with. Why didn't he see this coming?
Yes, well, that's the big question. And it's a question I've, in writing about this period and in my previous books too, I was always intrigued by the choices people made what the degree of danger they sensed. And even when they sensed it, what did they do or not do? And you think Freud, who had such insights into the human mind and who wrote about books like Civilizations and Its Discontent, where he talks about the infinite brutality of man, and he understood the danger of Nazism, but yet he did not want to leave Vienna. And that's a large part of the story of my book, is his attachment to Vienna, I almost consider Vienna to be a character in the book, not just the
people. Absolutely. Because the other side of the story is Hitler had a long-held desire to annex Austria, which was his country of birth, into Germany. And that's what goes on during the course of this book.
Yes. In fact, in Mein Kampf is what he wrote, his so-called autobiography, which he wrote in prison in the early 20s. One of the first things he says that Austria, it should be incorporated into Germany. Of course, he was born in Austria, and always had that as one of his primary goals. But there are a number of factors here. Part of it is while Freud was very astute about the human mind, on politics, perhaps he was not quite that astute, and he really hoped that the Austrian leaders, who were, by the way, were fascists themselves.
No kidding. I know.
It's like not an order of Hitler, and wanted to maintain an independent Austria. He thought they might fend Germany off. But the other big factor was, when all this is happening, Freud is already an old man. A lot of people don't even associate Freud with this later period in the Nazis, because he was born in 1856. So he's the man from the 19th century, and he's known mostly for his discoveries, his theories, his writing in the beginning of the 20th century. And the fact that he lived until he was 83 years old, right to the beginning of World War II, is something frankly a lot of people don't even associate with him. And so there he is, and he is in Vienna. He's a man of very conventional habits. He's a revolutionary thinker, and he's got all these theories which shocked the world about the subconscious and human sexuality. But in his own life, he was very conservative with a small C. He had his strict routines. The way he conducted his life, what time he had breakfast, lunch, and when he met his patients, when he wrote, when he went to the cafes to read the newspapers. And he really did not, he had a very comfortable existence and did not want to break the pattern. And so he kept it, and he was also in failing health. You always see those great pictures of him with a cigar. Well, he was addicted to cigar smoking, and that created cancer of the jaw, which started as early as his first operation was in 1923. And then for the rest of his life, he was having operation after operation, very painful. And so he was also feeling less and less mobile, less and less willing to contemplate being uprooted. So he in effect was in denial that this black cloud, which was gathering all around, was going to descend on Austria.
It's fascinating because other people got out, like Einstein.
Yeah.
And people would talk to him, and he was just settled there. I mean, it was almost like he was lost in his theories and just was hoping, well, it'll all pass. This too shall pass. Nazis showed up at his house, didn't they? And get money from his wife and his daughter, Anna?
Yes. Well, what happened is, there he is, it's 1938. And in March of 1938, Hitler orders his troops into Austria to finally incorporate Austria into the Reich. Austria does not put up any resistance because the Austrian government realized it's futile. And Hitler is literally giving a speech a short walk away from Freud's apartment and office, which, by the way, is today the Freud Museum in Vienna. People can visit it. And then one of the first things some of the Nazis do is they show up at his apartment, and they show up in the Freud and his associates had a small publishing house on the same street, and they show up there, and they're threatening, and it's not clear yet what they're going to do with prominent Jews like Freud, but it's bad news.
Jesus.
And these thugs first come in, and Martha Freud, his wife, has the presence of mind to say to them, to act as if they're guests, and says, "Won't the gentleman come in? And by the way, we have some money on the table. Perhaps you'd like to take that." And it's very interesting that Martha Freud, who's sort of in the shadows often and underestimated, is this very savvy woman. And instinct, and she tries to protect Freud. But then this whole drama appears, which goes on, which is the last part of my book, which is what happens. Is Freud going to get out? Will he agree to get out? He's still a little bit in denial, and that's when all his friends and associates, the people I call his rescue squad, come in and say, "This is the moment. You cannot delay any further. If we have to get you out." And how do you get him out?
That's the point of the book. Don't give anything away.
I don't want to give too much away, but and then where do you go?
Right. The amazing thing is that it got to that point. I mean, after the Nazis showed up at his place, Anna was totally distressed. She considered suicide, and she talked to him about it.
Not only did she consider suicide, yes, she did say to at that first night after those thugs left, "Should we all commit suicide?" And Freud just says, "Why? Because they want us to?" And that was sort of typical Freud. I'm doing it. And they're not going to make it. But Anna then turns out to be, and she's his youngest child. They had six children. And Anna is the one child who's still living with her parents, and who is not married, and who is totally devoted to her father, and she has become a famous as psychoanalyst herself, a child psychoanalyst, and she's also in effect his caregiver. She's the one who takes out this horrible prosthesis that he has to wear because of his operations of the jaw and so forth, and she's not going to leave him, and she then tries to deal with the Nazis as much as possible to shield her father. But here's a key thing about Anna in this situation. And Freud suddenly realizes, look, I'm not just talking about myself and Martha, my wife. We're old. We're not going to be around that much longer. But Anna, who's totally devoted her life to me especially, is not going to leave me. So if we have to get out for her sake as more than even for our own sake, because she has a long life ahead of her if they escape. But if they stay, who knows? Go ahead.
There's a list of rescuers. We're going to just talk about them each in turn.
Right.
But this book is, first of all, a biography of Vienna, but also it's a biography of Freud. And a biography of each of the rescuers. And each one is a very different person, and each one has a story that could have been a book in and of itself. As you mentioned, Anna Freud is one of the key people that rescues Freud, Sr. But Ernest Jones, Man of the World, William Bullitt, Marie Bonaparte, Max Schur, and the wildest one that is the strangest one is Anton Sauerwald. Yeah. Who's a Nazi?
Yeah. This is, when I began exploring the story, I have to say, when I started this, I never had the intention of writing a book about Freud. I didn't, like a lot of people, I took Psych 101 in college and so forth, but this was just sort of a passing interest. And Freud seemed this very distant figure. But then when I discovered this story about his escape, and then the people around him who helped make it possible. If you devised the cast in a novel, it would be impossible to come up with a more sort of almost zany cast. Yeah, Marie Bonaparte.
I want to read an entire book about her.
Yeah. She's worth, as you say, almost each of these characters. But she was her grandfather was Napoleon Bonaparte's brother, and she herself was from a very flamboyant life and a very flamboyant sexual life. With, of course, people attracted to Freud tended to have that, and he came to Freud. But then she became devoted to Freud, a psychoanalyst herself and a major funder of the psychoanalytic movement. So. And very wealthy, so her support was important when, in effect, the Nazis began their extortion racket of trying to leverage as much money out of these families as possible. And then Ernest Jones, as you say, he was a young British physician. Oh, he was just finishing medical school at the beginning of the century, and started reading Freud's papers, which were at that time only available in German. So he studied German just to be able to read Freud. Jeez. And then becomes his follower.
He becomes the true believer, the acolyte supreme.
Yeah, the true believer. And also he's riddled by scandal. Every place.
I want to talk to you about, because that comes out in your book, obviously. He's wanted for sexual impropriety and brought to court several times.
Yes. I mean, my editor, when I showed him the chapter on Ernest Jones, introducing Ernest Jones, he said, well, Jones was very lucky. He did not live in the age of the Me Too movement.
No kidding.
And
for people locally, the famous photograph of Freud at Clark, there's G. Stanley Hall in the middle in the front. And then Freud and Jung flank him. But right behind G. Stanley Hall is Ernest Jones. And ever since I've seen that photograph, he always looked like he was stoned. he has a weird look, like he's just transfixed behind G. Stanley Hall.
Right. Yeah, that's a wonderful photograph, and I hope some of your listeners will look it up. But it's
in your book.
It is in the book. Yes, that's true.
But what a strange collection! It's just amazing that it was like this. It took this many people, this supreme effort to sort of pick him out of Vienna like a tick off a dog. I mean, let's talk about Vienna for a moment. What is it about Vienna that both attracted Hitler and Freud? I mean, I've never been to Vienna. Is it something that was very particular about us, Vienna and Austria at that time?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, I've spent a lot of time in Vienna. When I was based in Europe for Newsweek, I would cover Austria was part of my beat, and it's an enchanting city in many ways, but it also has its very dark history. I write in the book that there's sort of what I call Freud's Vienna, which is when he grew up, it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was Imperial Vienna, the Habsburg family. And of all the empires in Europe at the turn of the century, it was probably the most tolerant. It was very ethnically diverse. It was politically less repressive than a lot of other places. And it was also, Vienna was a magnet for Jews from this multinational empire. And about 10% of the population of Vienna was Jewish. And even though there was definitely strong anti-Semitism, a lot of Jews prospered and did well, especially in the arts, the sciences, and someone like Freud, who was, of course, a top student and then went to medical school and so forth, he was very much aware of anti-Semitism and confronted it, but whenever he did, but did not feel that he was blocked by it. But at the same time, then you have Hitler, who comes along later. He was born about 30 years after Freud, and he thinks he's going to be a great artist, and he applies to art school in Vienna. And he's totally shocked when he's rejected, and he descends into kind of the dark corners of Vienna, where there are a lot of down and out people and all sorts of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and that's where probably his ferocious anti-Semitism was really nurtured as a young man, and so you have both of those Viennas, but. If you go to Vienna anytime today or in recent times, the magnificence of the architecture, the music, the setting, you can't help but be struck by what a vibrant and what a beautiful city it is. But also, then there are all these ghosts of the past.
There's an interesting quote in your book. I think it's by Karl Kraus. Vienna is the laboratory of the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you elaborate on that? Like, that's a very scary sort of.
Yeah, that's exactly that feel of turn of the century Vienna, where it, on the one hand, you had a flourishing of so much of education, the arts, and so forth. And at the other hand, you had a flourishing of every extremist movement. And every radical of the right, of the left. Very strong nationalistic movements. Remember, the Austrian Empire also encompassed the Balkans. World War I started with the assassination of the Archduke in Sarajevo. It's a place where everything seemed possible, both terrific stuff and terrifying stuff.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is author Andrew Nagorski. He's been the Newsweek's bureau chief in Hong Kong, Moscow, Rome, Bonn, Warsaw, and Berlin. And we've been talking about his new book, Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. What's great about your book is you essentially effortlessly seem to insert the entire history of the psychoanalytic movement into this book. Which I found fascinating. How did World War I affect the psychoanalytic movement? Because that's the precursor to what goes on when Freud has to get out of there.
Yes. I mean, World War I is interesting because the psychoanalytic movement really starts around Freud's table in his apartment. He's got Freud and a few friends who are his friends from the medical profession who are interested in the mind. And the inner workings of the mind, and it begin to expound on these theories. And by the way, Freud started as a medical researcher, and then but was always interested in figuring out something more about the human mind and why do certain people have such major disorders, psychological disorders. And he experimented with cocaine, he experimented with hypnosis, and before he finally came upon this notion of what was first called the talking cure, which he wisely rebranded as psychoanalysis, a much better term. And so here they are, most of these people in that early movement are Austrian Jews, Hungarian Jews, a few non-Jews, but mostly it's a circle which is Jewish, and which is important to know simply because Freud himself, by the way, was an atheist, but he always, never denied his Jewish heritage.
Right.
Freud was also eager to get non-Jews involved, and that's why, for instance, someone like Carl Jung, Swiss psychologist, brings him on board, and they become friends, and then they become enemies. But gradually, they expand it, and World War One is when this movement has to sort of just hunker down and try to survive. And most of the people are on the German-Austrian side of World War One, except for someone, of course, like Ernest Jones, who's on the British side. But the horrors of World War One only accentuate the need in their minds for psychoanalysis. And how do you deal with what we now call post-traumatic stress? There's so many people are coming out of those trenches and out of that horrifying warfare and can't function. So that also spurs on further work on psychoanalysis. So World War One helped shape their worldview. And by the way, Freud's three sons, all of them served in some capacity in World War One. So the war affects everyone very directly, and they come out of it trying to use this new theory of psychoanalysis, the new practice of psychoanalysis, to help people directly, and suddenly in the 20s after World War One, psychoanalysis becomes a major movement, attracting the attention of people all over, including a lot of Americans.
Did the Nazis think of psychoanalysis?
First of all, they were suspicious of it because of Freud and other Jews who were involved, and they tended to dismiss it as a Jewish pseudoscience.
Yeah,
they would say, because it also talks about inner workings of the mind, as if you can't just program everything in human condition, but. At the same time, they had some efforts to study the human mind, and they actually very quietly borrowed some theories and some practices from psychoanalysis, but they didn't call it that. And they hated the Freud association. And when the Nazis came to power in 1933 in Germany, and they had that famous burning of the books in May of 1933, particularly in Berlin, but in other cities, one of the first books that they burned were Freud's books.
You mentioned Jung before, and there's still to this day, people go, he was a Nazi sympathizer.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, he definitely sort of flirted with the Nazis. One thing to make sure you have to understand is that Jung and Freud split long before the Nazis came to power.
Right.
So that was not a factor in their relationship. But later on, Jung made statements that could be interpreted very much as at least explaining, quote-unquote, or understanding the Nazis, and being mildly supportive. He always denied he was a Nazi sympathizer, but that's something that's hung over his reputation up to this day. And there's reason to question some of his very ambiguous statements about the Nazis.
This book ends in sort of a sad story at the end. Ultimately ends up in Britain, and I'm not going to talk about how that whole thing is arranged, but the one thing I do want to talk about, and we only have a minute left, he really wanted to become a citizen of Britain, and he was denied it.
Yes, because Britain had had citizenship laws that for you had to live there. I forget for how many years. I have it in the book. I think at least five.
I couldn't believe they couldn't sort of bypass that. Was that a purposeful anti-Semitic take on by Britain on that?
I don't think it was at that point directed at Freud, but they refused to bend the rules for him, even though there were people pleading for them to do it. But I remember he was only in Britain 14 months before he died. So it would have the lobbying effort, which was made, was pretty, did not have a lot of time to succeed. Britain, the Brits could be pretty stiff. And, even for him, for Freud, there was a big deal that they made an exception to allow Freud and his family and some associates to come in, because Britain, like many other countries, including the U.S., by the way, that was not eager for Jewish refugees fleeing the Third Reich.
In the details of his life, he was trying to do work as long as he could, as it was possible, right towards the end.
Freud was determined to keep writing. He was receiving patients. He set up his house was set up. His son, who was an architect, helped set up his house, which again, the other Freud Museum is in London, where his old house, which is a wonderful museum, and it's got a lot of the famous Freud artifacts, including his original couch, which they managed to get out of the.
We're completely out of time. My guest tonight is author Andrew Nagorsky. He's been Newsweek's bureau chief in Hong Kong, Moscow, Rome, Bonn, Warsaw, and Berlin. And we've been talking about his new book. It is really a fascinating read. There's so many threads in it. Saving Freud, The Rescuers Who Brought Him to Freedom. Andrew, it's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for me, Mark. Thank you very much.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.